Okay, so what we're going to do this evening is we're going to take a closer look at divine revelation. And this is just to help you. If you don't know the scriptures, you don't know Christ, right? St. Jerome said that. Ignorance of scripture is ignorance of Christ. So we're going to have the most basic introduction to the New Testament here this evening by taking a closer look at the Gospels and letters of Paul. And hopefully by the time this is over, you'll have a basic understanding of the Gospels and the letters of Paul that will make you better educated and better prepared than most people sitting in the pews on a given Sunday morning. Because it's really not that difficult, as long as it's made clear. So my endeavor this evening is to make it as clear as possible. So we're going to start with the Gospels, and we're going to start by taking a look at the word gospel. Because when we say gospel, most people think of the four Gospels, right? And hopefully everybody here knows there's four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's not a newsflash to anyone, correct? Good. All right. The word gospel was used before anybody ever wrote a gospel. The Greek, as you have here in your notes, evangelion, literally means the good announcement. And so the early Christians would refer to largely Greek speakers, they would refer to the message of Christ as being the good news. What was the good news? What did they mean by that? Well, they weren't referring to a book. They weren't referring to a gospel book because they hadn't been written yet. One of the points that I'll make here this evening is that, do you all know that Jesus died, give or take, in the year 33 AD? Do you know how we know that? I'll tell you how we know that. A rabbi would begin his ministry at the age of 30, and Jesus preached for 3 years. As I'll get to here in a moment, the Gospel of John and the Gospel of John alone tells us that Jesus lived through 3 different Passover cycles. It's the only way we know that he preached for 3 years. That's why we say that Jesus died in the year 33. Okay? Now the Gospels, those are a lot easier to date. And they believe the first Gospel ever written was the Gospel of Mark, and that was written in 67. Now think about that. Think about 1967 versus 1933. That's a lot of time. A lot of stuff has happened. So for all those years, there are no Gospels at all. And there's Christians meeting for Mass, and there's Christians learning their faith, and they're living, and they're dying, and they're sharing faith with one another, and they're starting new families, and there's no such thing as a New Testament. Not a word of it has been written. But they're all using the word gospel. When they used the word gospel back then, what were they referring to? The good news. Now, what's the good news? Well, they were referring to the death and resurrection of Christ. And by extension, what that means is that for all of you who are born into Christ in baptism, you have the power by God's grace to live forever. And isn't that the one thing that we all really want? You might not think about it consciously, but suppose I could give you a magic wand, and all your wishes could come true. What might you do with that magic wand? Maybe you'd wish for $1 million. Maybe you'd wish for $100 million. Maybe you wish for $100 billion. Maybe you'd wish for eternal youth. Maybe you'd wish for eternal health. Maybe you'd wish for, who knows what you'd wish for. But I'll tell you this much. If it wasn't eternal, it wouldn't be worth anything. If it all comes to an end in death, go home and think about it. But I think you'll agree that if it has to come to an end, what's it worth? Nothing. The good news is that God has destined us for eternal bliss, perfect love, perfect truth forever and ever and ever. And the proof of that is that Jesus Christ can't stay dead. He's the only religious leader in all of history who predicted his own death, predicted that he would come back from the dead, and then did it, thus showing he was more powerful than death itself. No other religious leader in history has ever done that. They wouldn't dare, because they were mere men and had no power over death. So that was the good news, right? The good news. Hey, everybody, good news. Death is not the end of the story. Live for Christ and you will live forever. So they preached this good news to one another and they led people to believe. And what happened eventually was that, they began to be afraid that the very first people who had ever heard this message were all going to die out. Because what happened? They started persecuting Christians. You all know about the persecutions of the ancient Romans. You've heard that, yes? Throwing them to the lions and such. You know, they covered them with tar, lit them on fire. No joke. It was they lit up the Roman Forum at night with human beings burning to death. It's a cruel time. Very, very cruel, very cruel time. But they started persecuting Christians. It started about the Emperor Nero, about the year 66, 67 AD. And they began to be afraid these people would die out, so they started writing it down. Right? These became known as the Gospels. But understand, for all those years, it was just word of mouth. It was all done orally. Okay? So we've got four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You ever stop to wonder, why do we have four? Why not six? Why not eight? Why not one? Why not just one Gospel with one message about one guy? Why do we have four? I'll explain, hopefully, by the end of this evening why we have four and why it makes sense that we have four. But think about it this way. If you've ever been to an art museum and seen a famous work of art, like a statue, or maybe you've gone down to the Smithsonian in D.C. and you've seen the Hope Diamond. You ever seen the Hope Diamond down in D.C.? What can you do when you see some fancy thing like the Hope Diamond in a museum? You can walk all around it, right? It's not static. You can look at it. I went to Italy once and I saw the famous Michelangelo's David, and it's in the middle of a room and you can walk all around it. Why can you walk all around it? Because taking it in from just one point of view isn't enough. It's a work of art. It deserves to be admired and taken in. Well, the life of Jesus Christ is to be compared with that. It's such a big deal that we want more than just one point of view. That's why there's four Gospels, because there's four different angles that we can use to look at the life of Jesus to get a fuller understanding. Now, those are our four Gospels, okay? Now, three of those Gospels are very similar: Matthew, Mark, and Luke. A lot of the stories are the same. A lot of the content is the same. Some of the words are exactly the same. And if you read through Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you'll almost feel like you read the same book three straight times. It's not exactly the same. There's subtle differences, points of view that you get in one that you don't get in another. And there's stories that are in one that aren't in another. Okay? But they're very, very similar. And they're all in one category: Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They're all in one big basket. And that category is called synoptic. I'm just curious, who's ever heard that word before? Maybe you have to go to seminary to have heard that word, but synoptic is a word to refer to the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Syn means one, and optic means point of view. They're all kind of similar, the synoptics. And then along comes another Gospel, the Gospel of John, and it's totally different. Entirely different stories, entirely different narratives, entirely different monologues and words of Jesus that are found nowhere in the other three Gospels. And let's take a quick look now at these Gospels and what they are, and hopefully this will become clear, okay? So we're going to start by looking at the Gospel of Mark. Why are we starting by looking at the Gospel of Mark? Because it's believed that Mark is the oldest Gospel. Now, you might be really smart, you might be sitting there in your chair thinking to yourself, aha, well, if Mark's the oldest Gospel and you're starting with the Gospel of Mark, then why does the Bible start with the Gospel of Matthew, huh? Answer me that. Why does the Bible say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but you're telling me Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John? The answer is because for many, many, many years it was believed that Matthew was the oldest. I don't get all the reasons why, but there's kind of a consensus in the last couple hundred years that Mark's actually the oldest Gospel. Okay, so that's why we're starting with Mark. Okay, so what's Mark? What's the Gospel of Mark? Well, it was written in Rome around the year 67 AD. What was happening in Rome around the year 67 AD? Persecutions. Started with the Emperor Nero. Okay, and everybody heard about Nero fiddles while Rome burns. You heard that, yes? Okay. Wasn't known for being a very wise leader, wasn't known for being a very smart leader. And he's the first one to blame the great fire of Rome on someone other than himself. He blamed it on the Christians. And so they started killing Christians. They started writing the Gospel. And there was somebody in Rome, his name was John Mark. And he was a companion of St. Paul. He'd come up from Jerusalem with Paul on a boat, and a cousin of St. Barnabas. But the most important thing about John Mark is a scribe of St. Peter. So what Mark did was he wrote down the preaching of Peter. Was Mark one of the apostles? He was not one of the apostles. I can list you 12 apostles of Jesus, and Mark was not one of them. Even though everybody thinks he was one of them because they've heard his name a lot. There's lots of St. Mark's churches out there, and St. Mark's Square in Venice, and St. Mark this, and St. Mark that. Mark was not an apostle. He was a companion of St. Peter who wrote down what Peter preached. So when you hear the Gospel of Mark, you're hearing the Gospel according to St. Peter. The Gospel of St. Peter is what you're really hearing when you hear Mark. Now, Mark was in Rome. Why did Peter go to Rome? You know Peter went to Rome? Why isn't the church centered in Jerusalem? Why isn't the church centered in Israel? Why is the church centered in Rome? You may never have asked yourself that before. But the answer is, the church is centered in Rome because St. Peter went to Rome. St. Peter went to preach the gospel to the Romans, and that's where he was killed. And who took over from St. Peter? The next pope, whose name was Linus. We'll get to that later when we talk about the church. But the reason why the church isn't centered in Israel, the reason why the church isn't centered in Jerusalem, the reason why the church isn't centered in ancient Antioch or anywhere else is because Peter, the head of the apostles, went to Rome and died in Rome. And that's why Mark wrote the gospel that he wrote. It was all part of God's providence. It was written to people living in persecution to try to help preserve the faith and to give them hope. Now, when you're living in persecution, sometimes you tend to be direct and blunt. If people are fighting a war, they don't have time for pleasantries. They just tell it like it is. That's Mark. Mark is the simplest, bluntest, most straightforward gospel. And if there's one thing you find in Mark that you don't find anywhere else, it's that you see the human side of Jesus. And that's what you want to take away from the Gospel of Mark. That's your big takeaway from the Gospel of Mark. What does Mark teach us that no other gospel teaches us, or I should say better than any other gospel teaches us? Answer, Jesus' humanity. And I have some classic quotes here for you just to help make that clear. Little quotes from St. Mark. Mark says, Jesus was moved with pity. In Matthew's version, Jesus shows no emotion. Mark says, Jesus sternly charged them to keep quiet. In Matthew's version, Jesus just said to them, didn't sternly charge them. In Mark, why are you afraid? Jesus says, have you no faith? In Matthew, oh men of little faith. It's all much more calm. In Mark, Jesus sighed deeply in his spirit and said, literally what he sighed deeply in his spirit. He says, oh, you of little faith, how long must I endure you? Full of emotion. In Matthew, just says, Jesus answered them. In Mark, Jesus was indignant at them. In Matthew, the story isn't even mentioned. So what does Mark show us that no other gospel, I should say, show us better than any other gospel shows us? Answer, Jesus' human nature and his emotions and his feelings and all that. That's what you get from Mark, okay? There's another thing that's in Mark that I just throw this out just for fun. And you might have noticed this before if you paid close attention to the Bible whenever it's been read or heard it. And it goes like this. Jesus performs a healing, performs a miracle. Maybe he gives sight to the blind. Maybe he makes the deaf man hear. Maybe he makes the lame man walk. And they're jumping for joy. And Jesus says to them, before they go back into the crowd, he says, now don't tell anybody that I did this. And what do they all do? They go and tell everybody that Jesus did it. But don't tell anybody. And it's the strangest thing. Why doesn't Jesus want people to know? Want to know why? It's known as the messianic secret. Jesus didn't want them to think he was the Messiah. Not quite yet. Not until he died and risen from the dead. Only then would people understand what the word Messiah meant. Because, and maybe you've heard this before, most people were expecting a political Messiah. A political, somebody who would conquer Rome, make Israel great again, right? Restore the greatness and the wealth of King David and King Solomon. All your political dreams come true. That's not what Jesus came to do. He came to win souls for the kingdom of God, not for the kingdom in this world. He didn't want people to misunderstand. So the people wouldn't misunderstand. He said, please don't share that I'm the Messiah, not until after he died and rose. Just a little extra something that I throw in there, okay? But that's Mark, very briefly. Now let's take a look at Matthew, all right? Next page. Matthew, written just a few years later, all right? by an apostle, Matthew, who's also known as Levi. He's one of the apostles. Most Hebrews had Jewish names and also Roman names, something you'll get used to in time. But Levi was his Jewish name, and Matthias was his Roman name. And he was a tax collector. Do you guys know about tax collectors? You know, they were bad, bad people. Tax collectors had legal authority to cite an amount that you had to pay, and they knew how much they had to give back to the Roman government, and they kept the difference. And they had the legal authority to charge you whatever they wanted, and people hated them for it. They had a license to steal, quite literally, and people hated them for it. So who does Jesus choose as one of his top apostles, author of one of his gospels? Tax collector. To show you that if Matthew can convert and change his life, anybody can convert and change their life. But the thing about Matthew that sets him apart, and this is your takeaway from the Gospel of Matthew now, is that Matthew shows Jesus as the Messiah long awaited by the Israelites. Everybody knows the Israelites waited, long waited a Messiah. More than any other gospel, Matthew is the one who tells us that, okay? And he keeps trying to say this over and over and over and over again. 41 times he quotes the Old Testament and says that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Again and again and again, he says, this is the promise of the Old Testament prophets, that the scriptures might be fulfilled. The Gospel of Matthew begins with a great big list of names. I'm curious to know how many people already knew that. A few people. Great big list of names. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Joseph and his brothers. Joseph was the father of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he goes down through 42 generations. 42 generations from Abraham all the way down to Jesus. Why does Matthew do that? Because Jews care about ancestry. What's the only way to prove that you're a Jew? Does anybody know? You have to be born of a Jewish mother. Is it okay? Is it enough to have a Jewish father? It's not. Because everybody knows dads can come and dads can go. But right, if your mom's Jewish, there's no doubt you're born Jewish. So they wanted to know that this really was the long-awaited Messiah, because what they believed in the Israelite popular belief was that God had broken his promise. He promised to Abraham and he promised to King David that the line would never die, but the line died. God's promise was broken. The line died out. And Matthew says, no, it didn't. And I'll prove it to you. And he shows generation after generation after generation. So what does Matthew do better than any other gospel? He shows that Jesus is the promised Messiah of the Jews. Okay? Let's take a look at Luke. Luke, now this is written later, about 10 years later, in the 80s AD. No one's really quite sure. 86, 84, no one's really quite sure. And the man's name was Luke, and Luke was a physician. And you know that Luke was a physician because he's referenced in other parts of the Bible. But also, whenever Jesus cures somebody, the Gospel of Luke gives all kinds of medical details that no other gospel gives. Because Luke was a physician, that was his trade. Other people will say he was cured. Luke will say he healed up an effusive flow of blood. Right? Luke is very detailed in all of it because he was a physician. Now here's the important thing about Luke. He was a companion of St. Paul. So when you hear the Gospel of Luke, you're hearing the Gospel according to Paul. Was Luke an apostle? No. Everybody thinks Luke was an apostle because there's lots of St. Luke church, and St. Luke is a widely referenced name out there in society, and people think Luke was an apostle. He was not. He was a companion of St. Paul who wrote a gospel. So when you hear the Gospel of Luke, you're hearing the Gospel of Paul. Now, here's what Luke does, and here's your takeaway from Luke. What Luke does better than any other gospel is that he gives us the story of Jesus from a Gentile perspective. Because Jesus wasn't just the Messiah for the Jewish people. The Jewish people themselves believed, and still believe to this day, that God will save all the nations of the world. And he'll do it through his chosen people, Israel. What Luke does is he says that was Jesus. Jesus was the instrument. And now the message of God goes out to all the peoples of the world. So in Luke, They'll clearly explain like Jewish ceremonies, Jewish ceremonial washings, and they'll explain it to somebody like they're explaining it to a kindergartner, people who've never seen it before. They'll say, well, you know, Jews have these funny traditions and they wash their hands on the Sabbath day, you know, they want to make sure. And it's clear that he's explaining it to people who don't know. Because what does Luke do better than anybody else? Tells us that Jesus was the light to the nations, that Jesus was the one who came not just for the Israelites, not just for the Jews, but for all people. Okay? Couple little things to take away about Luke. Luke is the storyteller of the New Testament. Luke tells us parables better than anybody else tells us parables. Luke gives us the parable of the prodigal son. Luke gives us the parable of the Good Samaritan. We only hear those in Luke. You don't hear them anywhere else. Another thing that you get in Luke, an emphasis on poverty. Blessed are you who are poor, only said in the Gospel of Luke. An emphasis on Jesus' poverty and simplicity. Another thing that you get only in the Gospel of Luke is a story of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Only Luke tells us the story of the Annunciation of Mary with the angel Gabriel. Only Luke tells us of Christmas. You like Christmas? Thank St. Luke. He's the only one who tells us the story. The only one. It's fascinating that way. And you know what else is really fascinating about Luke? He wrote a sequel. And a lot of people don't know this. But Luke has a sequel. The sequel to the Gospel of Luke is called the Acts of the Apostles. You've all heard of the Acts of the Apostles, yes? Someday, go to the end of the Gospel of Luke and skip right to the beginning of Acts of the Apostles, and you'll find that it reads as one continuous narrative written to the same person. In my first book, Theophilus, I wrote of all that Jesus said and did while he was alive. The first book he's referring to is the Gospel of Luke, which begins to be addressed to somebody named Theophilus. In the second book, here, Theophilus, I'm going to tell you all that the church did. And the point of the Acts of the Apostles is what Jesus started in his life, the church now continues. That's why he wrote a sequel. Because he knew it would be hard for people. It'd be hard for people. It's hard for people to say that, you know, Jesus has died and he's ascended into heaven and the church now carries on his work. That's hard for people to accept. That's why there's a book called Acts of the Apostles. He wanted to make it clear that what Jesus began in his life, the church is now continuing. Okay? So, but what's your one big, big takeaway from Luke? Luke was the gospel that was written to the Gentiles, okay? And lastly, the Gospel of John. The last gospel ever written, and the most different from all the others, with stories in it that are unlike any other stories. And here's your big takeaway from the Gospel of John. John, better than any other gospel, emphasizes Jesus as God, Jesus' divinity. So now, you know why there's four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. One is to the Jews, one is to the Gentiles. One talks about Jesus' humanity, the other talks about Jesus' divinity. That's why there's four Gospels. Make sense? So John is the one that emphasizes more than any other the divinity of Christ. Do you know the story of Moses and the burning bush? And Moses goes up to God, who he sees in a burning bush, and he says, "What's your name?" And God responds, "I am." Jesus calls himself "I am" 54 times in the Gospel of John. He calls God his Father 118 times in the Gospel of John. Because John's trying to make it really clear, and he says it at the very beginning of his Gospel, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." The purpose of John, above all else, is to help you know that Jesus isn't just another great guy, another hero, somebody on the par with Perseus, the hero of the Greeks, right? Or some Roman legendary gladiator, some real great guy we can all look up to. He's God from God, light from light, true God from true God. That's the purpose of the Gospel of John, okay? Another interesting thing about the Gospel of John is the word glory. You'll hear it all the time in the Gospel of John. This is just to help you to better understand the Gospel of John. Glory doesn't mean fame. Glory doesn't mean your name in lights. Glory is a Greek word that means to make known. Everybody knows what it means to dox someone, correct? Everybody knows what it means. You don't ever want anyone to dox you, do you? No, because then they'll know your email address, they'll know your phone number, they'll know your... The word dox is a shortened form of the Greek word doxazo. And doxazo is the word for glory. So all through the Gospel of John, Jesus doxazo, made known. To make known, that's what the word glory means. So Jesus' purpose was to make known who God is. That's why the Gospel of John always refers to glory. And the place where God's glory is best made known is his suffering, death, and resurrection. That's where God is best made known. So hopefully that wasn't too fast, but Mark, Jesus' humanity, John, Jesus' divinity, Luke to the Gentiles, Matthew to the Jews. Got it? All right, now, far more difficult are the letters of St. Paul, but let's try to take a quick look. Most of the New Testament are the letters of Paul. Now, Gospels are a lot easier than letters. Paul is difficult because Paul's not telling a story. Paul's writing a letter. You've heard of the letter to the Ephesians. You've heard the letter to the Corinthians. You've heard the letter to the Thessalonians. You've heard all these, correct? Letter to the Romans. When you're reading these, remember, you're only hearing half the story. You don't know what made him write the letter. You don't know the other half of the conversation. It's almost like listening to one half of a phone conversation. You've been in those places where people are talking on the phone and it's the most irritating thing in the whole world, right? Because you can't hear the other side. Well, that's like the letters of Paul. So it does help to study Paul a little bit, just a little bit, just a little bit. But please understand this. The most important thing to understand about Paul is that Paul is a spiritual writer. Whether you know the other side of the story or not, please understand this. Paul is writing to help people know the answer to the central question, how do I follow Jesus Christ? What do I need to do? Paul's a spiritual writer. Okay? His whole goal is to help you follow Christ better. And you don't really need to know the whole story. It helps if you know the whole story. If you do a little bit of studying, you'll get a lot more out of the letters of Paul. But he helps you know what it means to live as a Christian. What am I supposed to do now that I've read these Gospels? Okay, so let's take a quick look at the life of St. Paul. Hopefully you all know this, but just in case you don't, Paul's Roman name was Saul, okay? And he had an enormous conversion experience. He was converted to Christ from persecuting Christians. He was stoning Christians to death and going and hunting them down and bringing them to trial and having them put to death because Paul was a rabbi's rabbi. Paul was a Jew's Jew. He was convinced that Christianity was a terrible aberration and destruction of all that God had revealed to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And he wanted it snuffed out. Who did God choose as the great apostle to the Gentiles? This guy. Which just goes to show you, if God can work through somebody like Paul, God can work through you too, okay? Paul was a tent maker by trade. He made a waterproof cloth called silicium. It's fascinating, this little, threw this in here just for fun. Nobody's really quite sure what Paul looked like, but we do have some indications, and they're not good. Paul himself says in 2 Corinthians, in appearance, I'm lowly among men. There's another letter called the Acts of Paul and Thecla, and this is my favorite description. Paul was a man short of stature, with a bald head and crooked legs, a good state of health, eyebrows meeting, a nose somewhat hooked, full of friendliness. So Paul was a short, bald, hook-nosed, bow-legged, friendly guy with a unibrow. Okay, that's St. Paul. But one thing to understand about Paul is Paul was a Pharisee. Everybody knows the Pharisees are the bad guys of the New Testament, right? They're the ones that are really strict. It's really not as simple as that. Did you know? Pharisees were the ones who took the word of God most seriously, but they weren't all bad people. Would it surprise you to know that Jesus was a Pharisee? There were different sects of Judaism. Pharisees were the ones who they didn't water it down. Okay, but Paul was a Pharisee, a strict observer of the Jewish law, fluent in four languages: Greek, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Latin. And as I have here, the turning point in Paul's life, his conversion. He's going to Damascus in Syria. He's coming up from Jerusalem. He believes Christianity is a fraud. He was there when St. Stephen was stoned to death outside the Jerusalem walls. And he carries with him a letter from the high priest of Judaism in Jerusalem requesting permission to bring Christians back to Jerusalem for trial because Damascus was known as a center of religious tolerance. And if you're living in a time in which, you know, you're living in like this little fringy religion and it makes people look askance at you and you know, wonder who you are and what you believe. You're probably going to gravitate towards a place of tolerance, not rather than towards a place of tradition, right? Well, that was Damascus. That's why all the Jews were living in Damascus. The Christians were living in Damascus. It was a place of religious tolerance. And on the way, he's blinded by a light from heaven, knocks him to the ground. And he speaks with Jesus personally, who gives him a mission, and he begins to live as a Christian. Paul was an apostle, accepted by all the 12 apostles, but was not one of the original 12. Just as an FYI, an apostle was someone called by Jesus Christ himself, a witness to the resurrection, called by Jesus Christ himself. He started with 12, but as time went on, more apostles were added. They elected Matthias to be an apostle, and then Barnabas, and then Paul, and then there was a third James. So there were as many as 15 apostles before the New Testament was finished. So a witness to Christ's resurrection, called by Jesus himself, and that was Paul, all right? Now, Paul wrote letters, and let's explain why. The reason why Paul wrote letters is this is what unfolded. And you can look at your maps that I gave you just for fun to help you understand. Paul went all around the Roman Empire preaching in synagogues to Jews who lived all throughout the Mediterranean region. And this is what Paul would do. Paul would go to a place like Thessalonica in Greece. Or he would go to a place like Corinth in Greece. Or he would go to a place like Philippi or Ephesus in what's now Turkey. And he'd make a beeline for the Jewish synagogue. Because he was a rabbi, he'd get up and speak. And what would he speak about when he got into the Jewish synagogue? He would speak about how Jesus was the Messiah he'd been waiting for. What do you think happened to Paul in the synagogue when he preached that Jesus was the Messiah he'd all been waiting for? They threw him out, right? They threw him right out. But some people believed him. Those were the beginnings of these little churches. After he went to the Jews, then he went to the Gentiles. And he started telling people that Jesus was the Messiah, not just of the Jews, but the salvation of everybody. Christ has died. Christ has risen. Christ will come again. So Paul went all around in three different journeys, okay, from the 40s and the 50s AD. And these are the oldest writings in the New Testament. They're older than the Gospels. The last letter of Paul was written before the first word of the first gospel was ever written. Paul's letters date from about 50 to about 67 AD. So the oldest writing in the New Testament were letters to the Thessalonians. So take a real brief look at them just for fun, okay? Just for fun. We're going to take a real brief look at them. Thessalonica was a town in northern Greece. Paul had lived there. He was run out of town by people who were upset by his preaching. And it was his first letter. Because in his time there was cut short, he didn't get to explain everything that he wanted to explain. And so he sent his friend Timothy back to try to finish his teaching. And Timothy comes back with good news. Everybody's doing well. The churches that you founded are still thriving. The faith is alive. But they've got a couple of big questions. Number one, what happens to us after we die? And number two, what happens to us at the end of the world? Those are their big questions. So that's what Thessalonians is mostly all about. Okay, mostly all about answering those questions. And it led to a follow-up letter, 2 Thessalonians. Because what happened was people were so convinced in this part of Greece that Jesus was going to come again that they stopped working. Because why bother, right? Suppose you sincerely believe that within a couple of years, you know, this is all going to end and God's going to come back riding on the clouds of heaven. Well, you probably wouldn't worry too much about your job. Probably live off what you had in the bank. Probably max out your credit card, go to Dunkin' Donuts, take a vacation, right? They stopped working. So Paul wrote 2 Thessalonians to say, hey guys, live in the present moment, trust that God has all things, he's unfolding a great plan. 2 Thessalonians basically says, hey everybody, get back to work. But the most important thing about the letters of the Thessalonians is they're the first letters ever written, okay? Let's talk about a couple more letters. The letters to the Corinthians, 1 and 2 Corinthians. Now, interesting story behind the letters to the Corinthians. Paul went to Athens, first of all. And everybody knows about Athens in ancient Greece, right? That was where all the great philosophers were, the great thinkers. So Paul goes to Athens and he tries to preach to them about Jesus Christ. And he tries to give them a very reasonable, educated, logical explanation for why Jesus is who he says that he is. And they laugh him out of town. Nobody believed him, except for one person, but we'll get back to that later. And Paul went down the road to the next town down the road, and the next town down the road was Corinth. Corinth was the last place you'd imagine anybody would ever believe in Jesus Christ. Because Corinth was a place of debauchery. Corinth was Las Vegas. Corinth was Key West. Corinth was a port town. In fact, Corinth was a town of two ports. Corinth was a place right in Greece where it was a tiny little peninsula. You could drag a boat across the land, and you could save a whole bunch of time. You wouldn't have to sail all the way around Greece. So Corinth was a great big port town. Corinth was a place of prostitution. Corinth was a place, one archaeological excavation of Corinth, they found 33 bars in one city block. Now, that's hard to do, right? And you got to figure it's supply and demand. There's a lot of people hitting the bottle hard in Corinth. So Paul goes down to Corinth trembling at the prospect of trying to preach Christianity to these people. And what does he find? A welcome reception. Grandiose success. Probably because these people, in spite of all of their debauchery, were deeply unhappy inside and were looking for something that all their debauchery was not delivering. Right? And that's very often the case. You find people the most debauched are the most empty, the ones most searching for something. Because whatever it is, this substance abuse path that I'm on is just not working. It's just not making me happy. So what's Corinthians mostly all about? It's mostly about Christian morality. It's about, hey, amigos, there's a right way to live and there's a wrong way to live, and you guys are living the wrong way, so get your act together and change your behavior. Corinth is a place, you've heard of the letter of the Corinthians in which Paul says, love is patient, love is kind, love is not jealous. You've heard that before, right? If you've been to a wedding, you've probably heard that reading. A reading from the letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians. I'll show you a way above all others. If I have faith to move mountains, if I hand over to my body to be burned, but I don't have love, I have nothing. The great treatise on love. Why is Paul talking about love to the Corinthians? Because they don't know anything about love. They know lots about lust, but they don't know very much about love. That's what Corinthians is all about, okay? It's a portrait of Christian morality. Now, moving right along, a couple more letters just for fun. The Galatians. This is kind of interesting. You've heard of Irish Gaelic, correct? Perhaps you know that Wales in Great Britain has a Latin name of Gaules. And perhaps you know that France used to be called Gaul. Well, there was a migrant people, and they went all across Asia and Europe, and these were the Galatians. And there's an area in Poland called Galicia, and there's an area in central Turkey called Galicia, and those are the ones where Paul wrote to. There's a place in Spain called Galicia. France was called Gaul. So it's all the same people, a great big migrant people. Now, this was the subject matter of St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, and it's actually very similar to his message letter to the Romans. When you're a Gentile and you become a Christian, do you have to go through all the Jewish stuff first? Because you guys know about Jewish dietary laws. You ever wonder why don't we live by Jewish dietary laws? You know about Jewish kosher laws, and you can't mix dairy products and meat. So like a cheeseburger is like the ultimate non-kosher thing to eat. And you can't eat pigs. So a bacon cheeseburger is a definite no-no if you're a Jew. You don't really want to make somebody mad. Take a trip to Israel, go up to a restaurant and ask for a bacon cheeseburger, okay? They might get mad at you. We don't do that here, they'll say. The question that Paul wanted to answer to the Galatians is a very important question. Very important question. You guys know you're sinful if you have a conscience. You know that if you died right now, you might have some explaining to do before Almighty God as to why you made some of the decisions that you made. So here's the question underlying it all. What sets you right before God? What puts you in God's friendship? Is it kosher laws? Is it Jewish dietary laws? Paul said that held a place until Christ came, but now Christ has come. What sets you right before God is faith in him. That's what Galatians is all about. And what does faith really mean? Complete surrender of your life to the Lord. And in that sense, are we all still working on faith? Yes or yes? Yes. Has anybody really arrived? Probably not. We're all still working on it. Your priest is still working on it too. But it's that faith that, yes, I believe, yes, I trust, yes, I strive to obey, yes, I strive to change my life to be more like yours. That's what makes you more like God. Because think about it. This is a little bit earthy and raw, but think about it from a grown man's perspective. Picture this. You live in ancient Greece. You hear about this great new religion. You love everything that it has to say. You ask, how do I become that? How do I become a Christian? And they say, well, the first thing you have to do is follow the Jewish laws. You say, great, great, that couldn't be so bad. And then they tell you about circumcision. And you say, wait a minute, I'm not sure I want to do this anymore, right? It was a big deal. It was really something to think about. So Paul, believe me, he wasn't motivated by what I just said. But Paul said, that's not what sets you right before God. Okay, that was the letter to the Galatians. Faith in the Lord and complete surrender to him. Paul's letter to the Romans. It's the most impersonal letter Paul ever wrote. He hadn't been there yet. Unlike all the other letters, he was preparing for a visit to Rome. And it's very similar to the letter to the Galatians. What puts us on good terms before God? And the answer is faith. And Paul goes into a little bit more in Romans than he goes into a Galatians. So I gave you an analogy here in your notes that I hope you find helpful. Picture this. We talk about Jesus as being a savior, right? So let's picture a circumstance in which you actually literally need to be saved. Let's pretend like you're drowning at sea. And there you are, you're thrown overboard from a boat. Maybe you are on, I don't know, some cruise ship. And over the boat you go. And you cry out, help, help, help. And somebody on board throws you a rope. And somebody yells out to you, grab the rope. And you grab the rope. And you hold on for dear life until they pull you all the way up on board to the ship. And when you're finally safe on board the ship, you say, thank you, you saved me, right? Okay, let's talk about what salvation is. And because some people will say that all you need is faith. And you'd have to have a somewhat broader understanding of the meaning of the word faith than that. So let's talk about my rope analogy. You could say, if you talk about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that the one who throws the rope out to you who is drowning is God the Father, because he sent Christ his Son to the world, right? You could say that Christ the Son is the rope. He's the one you want to hang on to. You could say that the Holy Spirit enlightens your mind, and he's the one who says, grab the rope. You want to listen to the Holy Spirit. But you have to hold on the whole way. It's not enough for you mentally to believe there's a rope that could save you, not unless you actually grab onto that rope. So what does faith mean? Faith means not only believing what you heard, not only believing what you're told, it also means having enough common sense to act on what you've been told. Right? There's a joke, you know, like Christian joke goes something, I'll give you the gist of it, goes something like this. Man's walking a tightrope, he's pushing a wheelbarrow across a tightrope on a circus display, and down below is the crowds, they're all watching this man walk the tightrope and pushing a wheelbarrow back and forth across a tightrope, and every time he does it, they cheer. And they say, do it again, and he walks across with the wheelbarrow across the tightrope. They all cheer when he walks across the tightrope with a wheelbarrow. And the man turns to the crowd, and he says, do you think I can do it again? And they all say, yeah, you sure I can do it again? We all believe you can do it again. He says, who wants to hop in the wheelbarrow then? Well, if you really believe, you won't be afraid to act on it, right? That was Romans, all right? Now, lastly, Ephesians and Colossians. It's kind of a little bit more complicated. This is a good example of where you need to study. There was an ancient religion called Gnosticism, which passed itself off as Christianity. And Paul was fighting against that with both Ephesians and Colossians. And he wanted to make it clear that Jesus Christ was not one power among many in the universe. He was the head of all creation. Right? And that without Christ, there's nothing but division in all of creation. Man against man against woman, woman against man, class against class, nation against nation, Gentile against Jew. But without Christ, there's civil war in every heart. And with Christ, this is what Paul was trying to say in Ephesians and Colossians, that's where you finally find peace. Now, there's lots of other letters. There's 13 letters of Paul altogether. I didn't go over all of them. You can look at them for yourself, but the other ones that I didn't go over are kind of basic spiritual advice, and you can understand them by context. But hopefully that gives you something of an understanding of what the content of the New Testament is, at least as far as Paul and the Gospels.